Hey, what's going on? I hope you are well and having a good week as always. I really enjoyed this episode. Robin and I just spent a bit of time taking a sense check on the whole space at the moment. Clearly, a lot of it has gone through a pretty brutal reset as part of the cycle, but it's now starting to show signs of rising once again. It's interesting to look at what's coming through as well. We talk about the MetaQuest 3 headset, which people have in their hands now, and mixed reality is starting to make a pretty big impact. We also talk about what NFT projects have survived and show signs of recovery, Artifact and Nike in particular, getting a lot of attention in the sneaker world. We dissect where you got are at too. Robin was also at Unreal Fest recently, so we cover that, what's happening with Fortnite at the minute, and his world record. He spent 50 hours playing Minecraft in VR, which was wild. As always, nothing in this episode is financial advice, classic, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. It feels like a positive episode, so let's get into it. Okay, good to have Robin back on the podcast this week. Loads to talk about.
So much.
He's back from virtual reality doing 50 hours straight, breaking a world record. We'll talk about that separately, but I've seen the certificate. Well done, you. Congratulations. But I wanted to start because there's a feels like a real sentiment shift at the minute. There's a lot happening that feels good. And we've had all the metaverse is dead and we've had all the NFTs of, you know, going to zero, all of that stuff. All those stories have happened. So it feels like, boom, that bottom is done. Everyone who wanted to sort of shit on everything has, and yet this space is not dead. In fact, it is rising back up again from the ashes. So, you know, this week we're seeing a lot of stuff around the MetaQuest 3, which is really interesting. The mixed reality stuff. I'm seeing a lot of videos go viral of just cool use cases. Somebody walking around their flat, grabbing a coffee whilst watching a MrBeast video floating in their real space and moving outside as they take their coffee outside. Just cool little things for everyday people where mixed reality is genuinely helpful. That seems to be going really viral. That's, from people who aren't necessarily in the tech space. Cool. It's getting some good reviews. We'll talk about the MetaQuest 3. I've used it. You've used it as well, Robin. Alongside that, there's obviously the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses. That's getting a lot of attention. These AI smart glasses looking very cool. We've talked about it before, but that's starting to find its way into the real world. There is the X-Real Air 2 and Air 2 Pro. If you don't know what they are very lightweight glasses. Look similar to kind of the Ray-Bans, but for AR, big digital displays. They are very cool and people are liking them a lot. They are out as well now. And wider stuff, like there's obviously a lot of chat about the Bitcoin ETF. Larry Fink from BlackRock, the biggest asset manager in the world, said recently that Bitcoin is a flight to quality. That's a big pivot point. Whatever the market does when that comes out will be interesting and not straightforward, I'm sure. And we're seeing around Artifact and Nike, the Air Force One sneakers that are being forged from these NFTs that everybody bought last year. The sneaker world is seeing them, and I'm starting to speak to people in the real world who are hearing about Artifact and these limited edition sneakers. Then we're explaining about how to get them. So there's all these things happening. Does feel like the bottom moment has happened and the sentiment is picking up. Where do you want to dive into first, Robin?
Yeah, well, you're right. There's always a cycle. And I think what's interesting here is that we're talking about a few different cycles simultaneously. There's obviously been a 10-year growth in tech stocks since the 2008 crash that, you know, saw Apple, Google, Facebook, Tesla, all these massive technology companies just rise to astronomical valuations. And that's one cycle we're talking about. There's obviously the Bitcoin cycle as well. And the metaverse has its own cycle. And the metaverse as a narrative is so clearly linked to the fate of Mark Zuckerberg's attempts in, you know, to transform Meta into a hardware company or a different kind of social company. And it becomes very, very difficult to know what the narrative or the cycle that we're looking at is. In terms of, you know, where we're at the moment, you kind of have to pick apart whether Web3, whether Bitcoin, whether that plays a part in the story of the metaverse. I think inevitably it does, because there's an idea of interoperability and ownership of assets and these kind of things. And then, you know, you've got stories like Epic disallowing people in Rocket League from trading assets between each other, which was a huge part of the game mechanics in Rocket League, which is just, you know, it feels like cutting off your nose to spite your face. All of these kind of things, it's a lot to think about. So in general, I think the promise that people have made, you know, whether it's 2, 3, 4 years ago, which is then fueled by VC speculation, which is this could be X, is we're hitting a point where some of that is starting to be delivered. And the Quest 3 definitely feels like a, if not pivotal, headset. I think the Quest 2 is more pivotal, particularly when it launched, but the Quest 3 definitely points the way towards something where more people can understand it or get a vision. Because it's like, you know, show, don't tell, isn't it? Like, so much of what the metaverse is about is very hard for people to wrap their heads around. But when you see something and it's got the word technology wrapped around it, you kind of want to have your brain blown a little bit. And AI has been stealing the headlines because a lot of what AI can do just blows your mind. But the Quest 3 has shown some things that people are going, oh. And it, like for the proponents of AR and XR, they're like, this isn't that new what it's doing. It's just the fact that it's an affordable headset that kind of sits there and also points the way towards where the Vision Pro is. I also agree with you, like there's always going to be a sentiment change where things flip around. They're always going to happen. With Artifact in particular, I don't think they ever didn't deliver stuff. It was just like they have a huge physical component to what they're doing, and physical stuff just takes time. You know, if you forge Nike shoes, they need to be kind of processed and turned into orders and then manufactured, and that whole process, it just takes time. So that was sort of a natural thing. But yes, I think when people finally got their hands on these Artifact Nike Air Force One shoes, there was a real sense like, oh damn, I'm proud to own these. Because a lot of what comes through the post when it's, you know, physical things from NFTs, you're not that proud of it. You think, oh god, did I really pay all this money for this? And it wasn't just the shoes as well. There's other items of clothing. I have some of these, and like I have the Varsity jacket, the Undead Varsity jacket, and I really like it. Do you want me to show it to you?
Go on.
Let me get it from my cupboard, though. I'll show it to you.
It will describe it for everybody listening.
I'm sorry for everyone listening at home, because this will make no sense. But I just want Luke's unfiltered reaction to the Varsity jacket.
Oh, okay. I'm going to describe it. This is cool. So this is like a almost bomber jacket, but it's a Varsity jacket, right?
Yeah, it's a Varsity jacket. Yeah,
it's a Varsity jacket. Makes sense. But it's like got a skeleton kind of on the back, and it's black and looks like leather sleeves, and it's just, yeah, it's cool. I think this is pretty cool.
Honestly, it is cool. It is cool. And the quality of the materials is great. I wouldn't feel ashamed to be caught out wearing this. I think, for instance, you know me, like I have the Adidas Alt, whatever it was, tracksuit. It's yellow. I wear it ironically because, I mean, who would wear a fluorescent yellow tracksuit anywhere? Well, I would, because I'm an idiot. But I like kind of making fun of myself in public. And you know this. This jacket, it doesn't need to be worn unironically. Artifact have crossed the boundary from cringe to non-cringe. And I applaud them for it, because genuinely, I love this thing. I actually like the jacket. I would wear this at a conference, and I would know that people would probably hate me for it. But like it would ask the right kinds of questions. And I'm down for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it does look good. And yeah, I think the key point here is, like, obviously, if you're looking at the negative side of stuff, I've cherry-picked some good things with that list that I started with. Obviously, it's been a lot of layoffs and all these things, but my point is kind of we've had the clear out now, really. And it's so interesting just, yeah, seeing, I don't say like normal people, but just, you know, people who aren't in this space start to take notice of certain things. Like, yes, a lot of the PFP NFT stuff has died and won't come back, but we're now starting to see what is surviving. An Artifact is one of those. And Murakami, I was in Hong Kong recently, and, you know, Murakami is a famous Japanese artist for anyone who doesn't know, but his stuff is everywhere. You're starting to see sort of the threads come together. Like the Nike Air Force One Murakami sneakers, they will be a legendary pair in the future. It's just people are beginning to arrive at this space. So we've all, as we've been saying for ages, have been here quite early. But yeah, we're starting to see from the ashes the winners that will rise and the ones that haven't died. And that is a nice place to go, because I think it's kind of up from here. It won't be a straight line.
For viewers at home, let me paint you a picture. Luke Franks is wearing a white cap atop his head. On the white cap is a blade, the blade of Artifact with the Murakami colors. He's representing right now. You're in deep, my friend. You're in deep.
We're in deep. Maybe we're just deep in the cult, but I think it's there is, as I say, a sentiment shift and something turning, which is good.
Well, actually, you know what? I mean, I'm just going to say it right now. I am one of the very few people in the world right now who has all 10 Clone X Nike Artifact Air Force One DNAs. I have all 10, which means, if you are following along, that I get the extra special 11th one, which is the Artifact, which is based on the what the fuck Nike mashup things. They did a special one for the people that got all 10. And I felt very foolish when I did, because it's like, well, this is just stupid. I don't even like sneakers that much. Turns out I really do like sneakers that much, and I like collecting them, and I like having them in a box. I'm going to do a video next week where I go through the entire collection, because I also have the original Jeff Staples Pigeons ones, the Meta Pigeons, which are not Nike, but they're kind of part of this heritage now. And then I have some of the Space Drip Air Force ones as well. So like,
that is a cool collection. Like this is a, again, like I wasn't a massive sneakerhead before this. I've got a few friends who are, and I followed their lead on stuff. And whether you are or not, there is a kind of culture shift here. These things will be important, and because of Nike's involvement as well. And yeah, it is interesting. We are witnessing a cultural shift, and these shoes will be, I think, you know, cool and sought after in the years to come.
But I should shout out Benito, Benoit, Chris Lee, Zaptio from Artifact, because they had a vision for what they wanted Artifact to be 3-4 years ago. I don't know if you've ever spoken to them, but I've spoken to them on different occasions, and yeah, just always enjoyed jamming and talking about what they're up to. And I think seeing the genuine excitement when people got their hands on these physical products, it's kind of nice to see where their original vision for the shoes and the shoe culture came from, because it's absolutely true to who they are and what they're about. They haven't pivoted from that. They've, you know, remained, you know, resolute in that. So that's impressive. So shout out to them.
Yeah. They have nailed and led the forefront of kind of gaming and fashion and sneaker digital culture. Like, that is the next generation. That's what they care about, and they are leading the way. So I do think they will be a very important brand of the future. It's probably a good time to talk about Rider Rips and Bored Ape Yacht Club, because if we're talking about a clear out of all the shit,
the muck,
and who's the muck and who's going to rise from these ashes, your bets would still be on Yuga, that they aren't going away. Maybe you could set the scene for the Rider Rips Bored Ape Yacht Club thing that happened and the result of it for what we've seen.
Okay. Yes. So Rider Rips is an artist. He's a very modern kind of digital artist. And he had a real issue with Yuga. The motivations around all this are somewhat difficult to pin down, but essentially it looks like this. Bored Apes were everywhere, literally everywhere. And as it turns out, there were some deliberate or not deliberate, quite uncomfortable elements in the Bored Ape collection that started a counter movement. Because when something blows up that big, there's a kind of natural resentment that builds up. We create heroes and then we want to tear them down. Where it ended up was that there were an enormous number of potential clues towards anti-Semitism and Nazism within the collection. And then that, alongside just this sort of generally obnoxious behavior of a lot of people around the Bored Ape Yacht Club, which I understand where it comes from. It's like, some people bought these things early and became overnight millionaires and were very protective of that position. And I understand why that is. But where it ended up was that Rider Rips sort of specializes in provocative and controversial art pieces. And over the years, he's done some that are really interesting. Like, genuinely, he's not just someone who can be easily dismissed as a troll. There is something interesting in the way that he puts his art pieces together and conceptual pieces together. So what he did was he launched a collection called RRBAYC, which is what he called protest art. So it was a collection that used the exact same images of the Bored Ape Yacht Club, but gave them a different name, and then sold them and made really quite a lot of money off the back of them, obviously infringing on potential trademark from Yuga. So this went to court. There is a famous message where I think it's in Discord, where Rider Rips is actively saying, we should get Yuga to sue us, because that will blow this thing up and it will make the collection massive. It will hype everything that we're doing. So really, you know, Rider's intention was for him to get sued. That was the whole thing, because then it pours more gasoline on the flames. And that's exactly what Yuga did. So Yuga had no move here, really. They had to sue him. They had to take action legally, because this was getting out of hand. This was getting pretty nasty. There was, you know, there were two protagonists in this. There's Rider Rips and someone called Paulie. Paulie is an NFT commentator, someone that hosts spaces, and also sided with Rider here, because again, it's just a culture war in a sense. So this has now been settled, and the news was that Ryder Ipsum Pauli lost, and they have been ordered to pay around $1.6 million in damages to Yuga Labs and transfer ownership of the protest art piece contract to Yuga. So one of the big sort of takeouts of this was that I think what Ryder was arguing is that this was a piece of art, it was protest art. He could use the images and repurpose them and thereby create an artistic message. And there was a sense of fair use being in play here as well. And the court threw all of that out.
That's a great summary. And it was interesting because at the time when all of, the crazy NFT stuff was happening, nobody knew any rules really about did traditional copyright laws still work here. People would assume they did, but like, it was the experimentation of a completely new space really. So nobody really knew what the rules were. And this case, I guess is kind of, showed some of the legalities and what that means. You can't just steal IP and stuff like that. So it has been an interesting precedent for using sort of digital IP and everything else online. This is a clear case of not being able to just nick someone's IP in a digital space and it be fine. And should say as well that Yuga came back with the criticisms of all the bad stuff that was said about it and kind of put out their own debunking video, didn't they, that the themes within it that were just all coincidence and everything else. So yeah,
yes, the thing was that it wasn't just kind of one or two things about the collection that were found to be objectionable. It was an entire Bible's worth. It was just one thing after another after another after another after another, like this Hawaiian shirt, this logo, this, that, this, everything. There was so much. It was a kind of an overwhelming orgy of evidence, and a lot of people were very persuaded by that. And also bear in mind that there was many videos that went really deep into the kind of obnoxious behavior of NFT owners and how deluded they were and how defensive they would get when anyone dared to suggest that actually maybe this wasn't as good as it was. Dan Olsen, Canadian videographer, being one good example of this. Now, I interviewed Ryder. I had like an hour and 45 minutes with him, and went toe-to-toe. I wasn't even going toe-to-toe with him, but I listened to what he had to say. And in particular, he was talking about conversations he'd had with Guy Osiri, who is the Israeli manager who manages Madonna, but also signed Bored Apes, who was using the fact that both he and Ryder are Jewish to basically bring Ryder over to his side, saying, why are you doing this? You can either play ball and be on our side, or I will crush you. And he played me messages from Guy that I couldn't put on the video itself, specifically saying this in support of what he was trying to put forward. Now, I think it's right for people to be critical of, projects like Yuga and NFTs in general. I think it's absolutely fair and right that people should be, because we need to question the motivations behind all those things. And also, people need to have contrasting opinions to balance out their worldview. I think the lack of that is, one of the biggest drivers of people's, unfortunate behavior at the moment. But what he shouldn't have done was release this RRBAYC collection, because they made money off it. They made a lot of money off it. And that was where they went wrong. You can protest, you can do all these things, taking on the trademark and infringing and playing down that kind of weird gray area. But the fact that they made money off it was when it was dead. And that was where he went wrong. In the interview, he claimed, because I questioned him on the artistic merit of what he was doing, because I thought some of his earlier work and some of the other things that he'd done were way more interesting than this. But he said, this is the best piece of art I've ever created. And I wonder how he's feeling about it now. He's probably digging in and saying, yeah, this is justification. This is exactly what we always wanted to do. I don't know. But it's...
It's interesting. I'll link the article below and you can see kind of how it wrapped up and follow the thread if you're interested. But I guess like the sort of theme of this episode is... that was all amongst the sort of hype and greed and artistic you know, protest there and whatever else was going on. But like, there has been a legal case now that has ordered him to pay damages. So again, like, that's sort of been cleared out and we start again. It's like, what do they call it when harvests and fields get fallow or whatever? Don't know what the word is, but it feels like the shit has been cleared out. Yeah, is kind of the point of this episode, which is interesting.
We've put manure on the field now. We're just going to leave it for a year and then we'll reap a rich harvest.
Well, exactly. There was a lot of manure that went on the field for sure.
There was a lot of manure. Worth also just contextualizing the fact that tech startups right now are having a really tough time. Like, it's just anyone that's trying to raise money in, you know, A, B, C, D rounds, like later rounds, dead. There's no acquisitions going on, which means that the startup space, tech startups, and that's what Yugo is now. It's not an NFT project. It's a tech startup building a massive metaverse game. It's a whole thing. A16Z should hold themselves accountable for what they did when they led the round in Yuga, valuing it at $4.5 billion. It's just, I don't know, it feels really, really out of whack. And if, you know, if you were an investor in Yuga, where does Yuga need to get to realize gains on that? Where does it need to get to? 10 billion? Like,
yeah, it's such a big ask, isn't it?
Epic Games is valued, or Epic Games was valued around like 20 or so, I forget the exact number, a few years back. And like, Yuga at Epic Games, that's how? It doesn't make any sense. So yeah, I have a real problem with the Andreessen Horowitz playbook in this space and how just completely out of whack they made it. So yeah, there's just a thing there. I think Yuga is.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, well, I don't know if you want to say, but what?
I don't know. I'm bearish. I'm bearish. I don't mind saying it. And it's not because I don't think they have something. I think it's because they are one of those unfortunate companies that have had way too much money pumped into them way too quickly. And they've also done a bunch of layoffs recently. And like, I understand why. Like, it's just, yeah, it's just stupid VC money warping everything.
Yeah, it's like the massive rise up. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like such a fast rise, often is followed by a fall just as quick, but we'll see.
Yeah, and you'll sit in a room with these grinning VCs who'll tell you, like, yeah, you're going to be this and we'll get you this and it's going to be this and we'll connect you up with that and all these things that you wanted to do, we can make them happen, it's going to be great. And you know now that like 2024 is going to be a rough ass year for a lot of projects. And if they can survive till 2025, I think they might be all right. But yeah, it's I fear for Yuga's sanity here, because what they're trying to do is build something to rival Fortnite. And as we know, we don't need another Fortnite, do we? Because we've already got one.
We've got Fortnite. It's really good. Yeah, I also think the other, I don't know if there's anything accurate with this, but like, I look at the space and really like the players of Fortnite and Roblox are a generation lower mostly than the people involved with NFTs. And that's fine. That's how it always starts. Same with like TikTok, was with the young generation in it. And there is a sort of demographic divide. But like, it feels like you grew up building a game. I mean, gaming spans across a lot of ages. I think the average age of a gamer in inverted commas is like 35. So maybe another side Fortnite style world would work, but you're sort of pitching it at kind of 30 plus people who, I don't know if that's their kind of what they've grown up with. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what who are they going after here? Like, there's
well I think with the other side, what Yuga is looking to build is an SDK that will allow projects with 3D assets to plug in and be part of that community, because you need content creators, you need UGC, but that UGC needs to know that its experiences can be monetized. So what is the other side's monetization strategy here? Because they don't have their own revenue. So if they don't have their own revenue, then they're going to have to create revenue through a game that creates trading. And we know that Yuga has been phenomenally good at creating trading and creating volume of trading, which is, you know, filling their coffers and has filled their coffers. But and so they're treasury wise, I'm sure they're fine. But at the same time, how are they going to pass on that value to incentivize creators to come and build? So I guess their target audience is other NFT projects that will then draft off that ecosystem and come and build there, which doesn't seem like the stupidest play, to be honest with you, because when things are hot and you know you've got a place to call home, I just don't know if they're going to have the game ready to capitalize on the next run up. So is it going to be ready by 2025? Probably not, which means then they're looking at 2028, 2029, and that's a long way off. That's a very long way off. You were talking about Roblox there as well, like this age gap. So obviously my kids play Roblox. They're clearly the target audience. Roblox themselves have said, this is Manuel Bronstein, Chief Product Officer, in June the 20th this year, Roblox is a platform for all ages where no matter how old people are, they can connect with friends and discover a wide range of relevant, engaging, and age-appropriate experiences. The fastest growing age group on Roblox is 17 to 24-year-olds. And in 2022, 38% of our daily active users were 17 and over. So this is a statistic. The problem with this statistic is it doesn't actually tell you where the weight of activity and the length of activity actually is, because it might well be that a 17 to 24 year old will drop into the platform for 20 minutes, whereas below that, 16 and under will spend 2 hours, 3 hours on the platform. And that statistic, you need it, and it makes a difference. I was speaking to a VC just last week and telling him, well, Roblox seems to be making this this assertion that the platform is aging up. He said, I don't believe it. And I said, Fortnite, I was talking to him about Fortnite and UFN. He's like, yeah, I'm bearish on it because I don't think people stick around and play on that platform and go beyond. Obviously, what I think Epic is trying to do is they're trying to expand the reach of Fortnite by, adding things like ratings guidelines in order to attract more mature experiences. We know, for instance, that Snoop is looking to build there. And if that starts to happen, then I think you will see an aging up of the platform, but the experiences still need to be good. I mean, his assertion was that people leave Fortnite and they go to CSGO, which I think is probably fair. And that Fortnite was seen as a platform for your teenage years and then you matured, and because that was just part of your growth process, you kind of outgrew it. But, I look at the top Fortnite creators and they're all like men in their mid to late 20s. They're doing fine. So I don't know. It's a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think I just remember watching it with YouTube and TikTok, and it was, TikTok was so young, people lip syncing all nonsense. And then you 3 years later, you saw like business advice gurus doing it on TikTok. And now it's just a platform, isn't it? So I think it really can age up. And one of the most popular experiences on Roblox at the minute is like a drinking game. For 17 plus, it's like you go to a bar and drink in the game and stuff like that. And yeah, so I think it probably will happen. I think it just all takes time for that next generation to come up, like the people who grew up with Roblox who were young and when it was much younger. And as they age up and the platform ages up and the next generation come in and they come there, like it all shifts over, but it just takes time, doesn't it? But yeah, plenty to still work out. None of this is massively obvious, but the overall narrative shift is these platforms and these technologies. That is pretty certain, isn't it? Talking about Fortnite, you went to Unreal Fest, which an interesting time to go because there had been all the layoffs at Epic Games and stuff. You did some good roundups, but maybe you could, for the podcast, just break down what you saw and kind of what you learned there.
Yeah, no, it was really good. It was really good. Having been to a bunch of NFT events over the last couple of years, interesting to go to one where there was obviously so much rich history and so much time that people have spent developing games and this sort of comradeship around it. And you got to see the full gamut of people from virtual production worlds, people who are coming from the YouTube side of things and using Unreal Engine. So I saw So Crispy Media, who made all the Unreal Engine stuff for Mr. Beast's massive Squid Game video. They were there. I saw people from the BBC, but I saw so many teenagers. It really was this strange thing seeing, 30-year developers rubbing shoulders with these teenagers and talking about UFN and what was going on there. It was so obvious that there was just this massive thank you moment from that community. Like, finally, we are included and we are important. We got to see Tim Sweeney up on stage just talking about the layoffs and about how difficult that had been. He was specifically talking about how they needed to move Unreal to a more like an Adobe style model, where if you were a big, you know, a big entity that wasn't a game developer and you were using it, you know, for instance, TV shows in the US all using Unreal Engine, not paying for it, they would now need to pay for it. So they're, you know, they need to start generating revenue at a little higher level than they have been. But as we know, that the vast bulk of Epic's revenue comes from Fortnite skins. And so it's very clear that they understand they need to broaden the pot of people that play that game. But that means that they need to broaden the number of skins that they sell. They need to kind of make that grow as well. And some of the things that have come out recently in terms of the algorithm changing on UFN bear that out, that they just need to generate more skin sales. But it was very clear from the kind of weight of the conference that UFN is the big bet. That's everything. And that the Verse language, which obviously Metaverse, it's the Verse programming language that powers a lot of the cool stuff you can do in UFN, is going to be the mechanism by which Fortnite opens out into a broader connected Metaverse ecosystem. And I think that at the moment you see it as this walled garden. It's all very much contained within the Fortnite brand. But slowly but surely, it's going to evolve, if they get their plans right, into a platform that is less about the Battle Royale, it's less about the Fortnite game itself, and Fortnite becomes this platform. But it's a long way off doing that at the moment. But as a creator ourselves, building experiences on there, it's really interesting to see how kind of important creators and the discovery system is to their future plans. And there's just a lot of stuff that needs to happen. But yeah, really, really interesting being there.
That's cool, yeah. And we've mentioned it many times before, but I continually see now like these experiences being part of a slate of like releases, whether it's films and like Barbie stuff, you know, there's a playable world on Roblox, and like it's, that is almost part of the norm now. There's a lot of brands who need to catch up, but it is in the lexicon and in the normal thing of like, we need to have an experience like this. And people are learning how to do that better.
Well, you've just said it. You literally just said it. This is the knee-jerk reaction. We have to have an experience in there. Nike did this thing. We have to have an experience there. There was a BMW stand there, and BMW built a whole thing. It took them 6 months to make it. But you can't drive a BMW car in the game. It's a really strange thing. Like they want to capture that audience. And I know that my son in particular plays games where he drives exotic cars in Roblox. And now he's obsessed with exotic cars. Like, he won't be in a position to buy an exotic car for a really long time, unless something goes on and he turns into the biggest Roblox creator in the world. It's unlikely that he's going to be buying a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, but he's got a relationship with these cars now through the game. So I understand that giving people access to something that they might fall in love with on a product context makes sense, because it does actually work. I've seen it firsthand. But there is just so much chat about UFN without any real strategy in terms of just getting a game out there, getting it seen, getting it played. Because the platform has its own rules in terms of who goes where and why they go where. And unless you understand that and take the time to really get under the skin of it, and also bed in and do the hard work of building your own brand on the platform, it's kind of just like, yeah, buy my skin or buy my thing, and then, you know, you have this experience that gets played once and then people go home and they never do it again. It's just, yeah, it's a tough one.
It's exactly the same as I remember, like, the brand's sort of realization, like, every brand needs to have a YouTube channel now. We need to make content. And then a few brands sort of made some content, realized they were rubbish at it because they don't understand how to make content. So then they started paying creators, and then we had the whole influencer content thing. Like, that feels like it's the same. It's like brands know they need to be on it now, but they don't really understand sort of how to make good games, because that is a whole discipline in itself. So it's that sort of shift happening again in the early form, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's worth noting. And for people listening, and for companies who might want to have a presence there, it's like, you're right, probably, that you probably, if you're going after that audience, need to have something there, but you need to think about how the right way to do it is and speak to the right people and get it built in the right way. Because just delivering something, if it's not good, people will just, it'll be a waste of money in it. So yeah, we're working all that stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, isn't it? It's like, if you get people to spend 20 minutes in the company of your brand rather than 2 seconds, it's probably a net win. But yeah, I think there's more you can do with that platform if you're prepared to put the time in. So, you know, for us, we are developing our own strategy for UFM, but it's I don't want to give it away now, because we looked at all the data, we looked at where people were playing and what they were playing, and have made a strategy accordingly. Because I think going after the existing player base and really connecting with them where they are should be the first round in a strategy to build a brand that players, the existing players, actually like. And then you can start to give them more complicated, more leveled up kind of experiences. Because like, you don't want to spend 4 months designing and building a game and then nobody to play it, because that sucks. So thinking of it much more like YouTube, and it's like regular bits of content, regular bits, you know, of regular games that people like, and that can be evergreen. I think that's really an interesting way to approach it.
Mm. And it's true of like memes and viral videos. Like sometimes it's the stupidest shit that goes viral. Like, and the you know, like up only up, whatever it's called, is good example of that, isn't it? We've talked about it many times before, but just people just chucking assets in a big jump up to the top thing. Like, not really that hard, but went massively viral, made loads of money. Like, sometimes that is true of virality in general, isn't it? Let's finish by talking about the Minecraft world records that you did, because that was completely insane. But yeah, talk us through it, how it went. Are you still tired?
Yeah, so the background to this is that early in the year, I ran an ultramarathon in VR chat, 39 miles or so, and we raised $100,000 for Great Ormond Street Hospital. They came back to us a couple of months ago and said, we are doing some world record attempts in October, and we were wondering if you might be up for, you know, trying and to break a gaming world record. So I kind of went back to the team and said, I'm not really a gamer per se. Are there any world records that I could possibly break? And we started looking into it, and immediately the thing that kind of leapt out was just like marathon gaming sessions. So we were looking at particularly Minecraft, because Minecraft is an open virtual world. It has all the hallmarks of a metaverse. It is a space that I didn't even know about. I'd never played Minecraft, and I really wanted to kind of do the zero to hero thing. So we looked at it and decided that the record we wanted to go after was the longest video game marathon playing a virtual reality game. So play Minecraft in VR for the longest time possible. So the record was 48 hours by a young man called Colin from the US. And turns out it's really, really hard. It's really, really hard. And it's hard because, well, firstly, you have to play the game standing up. So that's, you know, a good long chunk of time.
What, that's one of the rules as in the record?
Yeah, you have to play the game as it's intended to be played. And Minecraft cannot be played seated in VR, not properly. So I had to play it standing up. And you're allowed 10 minutes break every hour, because that's mandated for just your own safety and health. But you can stack those up. So you can go for 3 hours and bank 30 minutes of time if you want to, and then take that half an hour in one block as you want to. So it actually becomes quite strategic. So it's like, how long can you run and how much time do you want to build up? So in the end, I played Minecraft in VR for 50 hours and I broke the world record, which was nuts.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just me. There was, you have to have two witnesses at all times. There's a lot of admin going on. There's, you know, there's a whole bunch of rules you have to respect, because if anybody else wants to break the world record, they also have to abide by the same set of rules. So all of that was quite stressful and also quite expensive as well. We didn't realize, like, using the Guinness name and licensing it, that's where they make their money, my friend. That's where they make their money. But we did indeed do it. We got a certificate. And I think what was really interesting about this was a couple of things. Firstly, really living Minecraft from the inside out in VR. It's quite an experience. And also for me, it's a bit like that Bear Grylls Survivor thing where they drop a bunch of celebrities on an island and they have to fend for themselves and they're rubbish and they all get really skinny. And like, there comes a turning point where they figure out how to hunt and they get over their own hang-ups about stuff, and then they start to thrive. And as Bear would say, it's time to survive, but then to thrive. I really felt like that. And I spent two days in this thing, just living the Minecraft way. and building houses, but failing. In the first day, I just failed so hard, so often, because I didn't know what I was doing. And I had no real help at that point. I was just flapping about, getting killed the whole time, getting reset the whole time, just losing all of my, everything I'd built up, and also getting lost and not being able to find my way back to my base where all my stuff was. It just like, just really put me through it in the first day. And then in the second day, Tristan, who works with us, was in the game with me. We had a bunch of people from our community come and play as well. And it became this really fun social moment where we were all building stuff together, that we were all contributing to this world record attempt. And I just had to keep going. And I was really tired. I think I woke up at 8 a.m. on the day that I was doing the attempt, but I didn't start the attempt till 12 hours later. So I woke up at 8 a.m. on Wednesday morning.
So you stayed up for like 3 days.
Yeah, and I ended up finishing at 10 p.m. on Friday night. And I eventually got home around about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So I've been going for a really long time. But the second day, once we had people there and we were motivated by tasks and doing things, suddenly you just became like, I was in the metaverse. I was living it. I was doing it. We were creating a world together, socializing and communicating. And it was just like, yeah, this is it. This is what it is. And I remember we had this plan that I had to beat the Ender Dragon before the world record was up. And we were racing across the water to this island. And I remember looking around behind me and I just saw like 15 people just charging across the water with me. I was like, we're doing it. We're actually doing it. And I found myself missing it the next couple of days afterwards because I really wanted to get back in there. And I did. It was weird. Like, I think probably people would think that having a screen next to your eyes for that long a period of time would be the biggest stress point, but it really wasn't. It was my knees and my ankles that were just like standing up for 50 hours straight. And then we were doing donations as well. We were raising money and there were forfeits if people donated a lot, one of which was I had to eat de-bombed chili sauce. And basically my colleague Omar decided he put a lot on the spoon and it just screwed me. I was in unbearable pain for about 6-7 hours as this chili sauce worked its way through my intestines and I was just getting stomach cramps, cold sweats. It was bad. So I had all of that to contend with, but you know, we got there in the end.
Yeah, well done. That is an epic endurance challenge. That is serious stuff. What did you have, like any weird physical, because when you stay awake for 50 hours alone is like pretty crazy, but to be immersed in a virtual world, you must have either weird dreams the next day or just...
Yeah, you start to hallucinate a little bit. I definitely, the couple of physiological things that happened, like my knees were uncomfortable, but it was okay. I could keep moving around, but my hands started to feel like claws because they're holding the controllers all the time. And I started to feel like these things that I could feel in my hands. I was like, what is that? And I realized it was my own fingers. I just sort of completely dissociated from my own fingers. And a lot of the stuff, you know, in Minecraft is you have to think about what you're going to build. You have to open a chest. You have to get items. There's quite a lot of logical thinking involved. And certain things become kind of muscle memory, but other things are just like, couldn't do it. And when you're down in a cave and there's like a weird, there's a mob or a zombie or a skeleton, what I've discovered was like at far distances, because you're far away from them, they became way more realistic at a far distance than they would close up. So, you know, everything in Minecraft's all blocks and stuff, but at a distance, I'd start to hallucinate that there were these really high resolution monsters in the shadows. And also I would just have to really look into the shadows because I wasn't sure what I was seeing. I'd just hallucinate monsters in the shadows the whole time. It was very strange.
That's mad. Yeah. World record holder, best in the world. Well done. Congratulations.
But it's probably worth saying that the headset we used, we had to kind of flip between two different headsets. So we used the Quest Pro, which I used for the marathon, and we used the Quest 3. And I don't think there's probably anybody in the world that has spent as long as I have continuously in either of those headsets, probably to the extent that I have. It was nuts. So I for me personally, the Quest 3 is good. Resolution's good. Facially, comfort wise, I didn't love it. I came out of each session with the Quest 3 going, I'm quite happy to get this off my head. Whereas the Quest Pro it sort of tends to push down more on the top of your forehead. So as long as you don't tighten it up too tight, it's generally, generally for me, it was more comfortable. So if anyone else is out there looking to do kind of 50 hours plus in a VR headset, that's the one I would go for.
Looking to spend 50 hours. Good knowledge. Well, yeah, there we go. Well done on the record. And I think we've covered some good stuff there. The tides are turning. I'm sure there's still a bit of it's not going to be straight up from here, but it's interesting to take a sense check of the space. And it's not dead for sure. So there's, I think, plenty to look forward to. And it's a good time to be listening, building, and getting involved right now. So, yeah, I think it's probably the pod.
That probably is the pod. You didn't talk about the Quest 3 and your experiences with the device.
No, I can talk about it. Yeah, quickly. Yeah, it's cool. I played the Ghostbusters game that came out. Ghostbusters, The Rise of the Ghost Lord. It's pretty cool. Like, the mixed reality part of it is the big marshmallow man, like, rips your roof off. It starts collapsing in, and then he appears, and he's, like, looking over your ceiling. And then you have to grab the little floating mini puffed marshmallow people that are flying around. You have like an ecto gun. You have to suck them in. Then you have to fire them at the giant marshmallow man. But it's fun. It's really fun. And like, yeah, we've said it before, but the mixed reality thing, I think it's for people stepping into this world, makes loads of sense. Like, you can bounce the mini marshmallow people off your real walls and do like trick shots and stuff. And it's just like, you can see your friends and you can have that kind of physical social experience at the same time, which asks less of people, I think, is a nicer step in. It would almost have been better if that's how these headsets had rolled out. Obviously, technologically, they couldn't have, but to go from mixed reality first and then maybe you go into VR after. So it's an interesting moment. I think we're seeing why mixed reality is important.
It is. And I think what's fun about it is that your home and your environment is something you put a lot of time and attention into. Most people have anyway, and the placement of things. So when the headset's scanning the room and figuring out where stuff is and you have to place things, it doesn't feel like a chore. It feels like just a kind of, you know, designing your own space, which I think is really cool. What pisses me off is the Quest Pro has a slot for a depth sensor and they didn't put it in there. Because like a lot of the stuff that the Quest 3 can do, the Quest Pro can also do, but nobody has one. We had one because it was the right headset for the marathon, but it's slightly not as good. But also the hand controllers on the Quest Pro are better. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a few little things. But yeah, it's maps to your actual room so you can bounce the stuff off your sofa or hide behind your sofa to shoot the zombies. The bullets will hit your sofa and stuff. So yeah, it was cool. I enjoyed it. I think it's good. I think it's a solid headset. We'll see how it does. But yeah, nice. A good roundup. I think that's probably it. That's the pod.
That's the pod.
Peace.
Peace.